RDU 98.5. It's a very, very special moment for me right now, because I don't often get to do this, but I'm so delighted to have in the studio a legend, an icon, a change maker, and I get to call him my boss as well. Pylon is in the studio. Good morning, Mr. Pylon.
Kia ora, everyone.
How are
you? Thank you, Liam. That was very flattering. Very nice at this time of the morning.
Hey, yeah. No, good pick. Good start to the day, right?
Great start to the day. Oh, the best.
The best. That's right. How are you? Because obviously you've been very, very busy.
Yeah.
Last couple of weeks.
We're getting there. We're like tickets away from...
I can't believe...
I think I could probably count the tickets on my two hands. That's how many tickets are left.
Wow, that's insane. So, obviously, this is a rave revival. And there's been a lot of reminiscing going on through my interviews.
Cool.
And I do want to carry that on with you. Mm. And you would have... so many memories from this time period. But obviously it was you who wanted to revive this and kind of make something out of it. So what is it about this time period and this scene that is so special to you?
I guess for me personally, they talk about Halcyon, right? The idea of Halcyon days. Everyone has a time in their life when they can look back and go, oh, well, that was my moment.
Yeah, you know? Yeah.
And I was like, it was like a peak moment. And or it was so vivid in my memory that you know, it kind of sticks out now that I get older. And it's something as you get older, it might be RDU for you, for example. You might go on to better and better things, but you might always look back and go, oh God, those times, they're just so much easier. And I look back now.
Yeah, totally.
Like
totally.
Sometimes people look back at school even and think, shit, I wish I was back at school.
Much easier.
But, you know, that period in the 90s was, you know, I was between the age of 18 and 25. Mm. And, you know, I literally, it's the moment, you know, you go from being a boy to a man. Mm. And at that moment, you know, I realize, I'm like, I discover this music. And I discover this music on tapes, not going down to the record store, there's a few bars that were playing.
Yeah, interesting. You
know, but some actual travelers, some backpackers. You know, came into our social circles playing hacky sack and going out to the park and you're getting high and having good times and parties and you get given these tapes and you listen to them and you're like, what the fuck is this stuff? This stuff's amazing. Oh my God, I've never heard anything like it. I used to describe jungle as like, first when I didn't understand it, like an electronic orchestra of drums.
Yeah, right.
I didn't really like, what is this? Oh, it's so good. Like Groove Riders in 1992, Helter Skelter mix. I know specifically. And he plays on that. He plays music that doesn't get public release for another 3 years.
Well, that's a really interesting point I kind of want to touch on, right? Mm. It's like, it's almost a stroke of luck you kind of really discovered this stuff in the first place, right?
Oh, yeah, when you think about these guys coming through. I mean, there was a few other people. I mean, there was a groundswell, you might say, of appreciation for electronic music that was rising, and it happened to be in the early 90s. Internationally, is probably another 10 years on us. It was a 10 years advanced, so there was a lot of amazing stuff going on in the mid-80s. But specifically, the interest we had was in European music. This is like radio stations like FG Paris and then the UK. And this is where the UK is kind of the core of where my love for electronic music sort of sourced. While America was very well known for techno and house music. You know, the UK is known for breakbeat, for hardcore, for trip-hop.
Right.
You know, a lot of experimental music that, you know, there's a vast amount of it in the UK coming out. And of course, all of those records, it was records. So, like, records were being shipped over to New Zealand in small portions, but mostly we had to source, and this is when we got into it, and this is in, like, 1991, no, 1992. Mm. We're like... where do we get this music? We can't buy it here. Matt O'Brien introduced me to Echo Records, and he started importing it. This is Obi-Wan who's playing after me.
Yep.
He introduced me to all a whole range of music, and then one of our friends decided to travel over to Sydney to Central Records over there and purchase a whole bin of records to bring back.
Oh, my God. Wow.
Yeah, so we all, you know, a couple of them chipped in and paid hundreds of dollars, if not thousands.
Yeah, right,
and bought like 150, 200 records back.
That's kind of like a good investment, though, really.
Amazing.
Isn't it?
No, I've still got some of those records.
Yeah,
and,
wow.
And they are still today some absolute amazing pieces of music. Like, they're white labels, they're bits that actually they're very, very difficult to find now.
Yeah.
They're worth
quite
a lot of money. But they've kind of formed, and this is like hanging out in apartments and flats where you're in your social groups three times a week. Three or four times a week, you hang out, if not more, and you play music.
Yeah, yeah.
And you get in the, and you're literally just putting on house parties all the time. It's like, it's all on.
I mean, like, what a great time.
Yeah.
You couldn't not love it.
No.
Obviously, everyone, when they're younger, kind of, you know, we're all inclined to a party, and we know we enjoy partying, socializing, all that.
Yeah.
When did you kind of click that you had like a real particular interest in the music?
No, it didn't. Definitely didn't come straight away.
You don't
just pick it up and go, "Oh my god, I'm a great DJ."
Yeah,
You know, I bought, you know, I've got a collection of records that are like, they're all illustrative of my inability to understand the difference between genres.
Weird,
quirky kind of records.
Yeah, right.
I listen to them now, and like from a nostalgic perspective, but I would never DJ them. They're just so incompatible.
funny.
And then slowly but surely, like I said, I caught on to these mixtapes, and then I'd start to hear the particular releases. Matt was pointing me in the right direction. I mean, that's crucial, right? You've got a guy on the other side of the counter who's making these orders.
Yeah, yeah.
And he knows that you are interested in it, and so he buys more of that stock knowing that you're going to buy it.
Yeah, I mean, that's brilliant.
And so it was literally hand-to-mouth through that relationship, you know. And so we built up collections really quickly. I mean, I would say, I calculated it was about a bin a year. So about 150 records, or to 200 is about a bin's worth of records.
Right,
and that's how many records you would save and purchase. Every week you'd be buying more, and you'd be, you know, and ordering more. And so it's about 150 in a year. So you break that down, divide that by 12.
That's quite a lot.
That's quite a lot of records to be consuming every week when you're on the dole.
Hell yeah. That's insane. Did you eat or drink or like do other things?
Yeah. Well, everyone definitely lived out of each other's pockets a lot. But
And
you know, like, that's actually a really good point, because it kind of brings everyone closer together.
Yeah. Well, that solidifies the community, right?
It totally does. And everyone is like, you know, they catch up together. They do, you know, you live together in big groups. You socialize in big groups. You share a lot. You're literally eating out of each other's pockets. And then when you rave, or you go out to a party and put something on, it's a community thing. So there's that kind of connection going on with a lot of people who are coming along. The Saturday, they all were there. Lots of them came to the parties and helped us put up all these installations.
Yeah,
you know, they turn up at the gig, and then they stay there until the very, very end when the lights get turned on. They're all standing around going, "Is that it?" And you're like, no, it's definitely it. We've got to turn the sound off.
Yeah.
And they're all standing around, and they have a big social. So everyone just carries on talking.
Wow, that's
and
so just interesting.
It's really lovely.
Yeah,
and then
everyone
helps you kind of pack down again. And it's like, okay, great. This is actually a real community.
Yeah. And that I'm so glad you've touched on that, because, of course, this has all come about because you really got into organizing these raves and these parties yourself.
Yeah.
Back in the day, and I've been lucky enough to kind of see some of the footage that's been taken from back in the day and so on. And a lot of this is like, it's just in parks and in nature and stuff, isn't it?
Yeah. So we were the first kind of, I guess, adventurers. You know, we kind of
think
of ourselves as adventurers in that sense. And you know, and there's actually I spoke to this guy called Lewis Tennant. He does interviews in Wellington.
Yeah.
And he actually had a notion, there's an idea of when something moves from the suburban space into the urban space, right? And so raving began in a suburban and almost rural in the context of going outside.
Yeah,
and so a lot of and this is where you see sound system culture and stuff continues that today by taking, you know, like Massive continued it after us. That's Marcus Putner when he began it, and Matt Aiton and those guys started the another group. And so it wasn't just us. There was people even at the same time as us. And so Crybaby, who's playing earlier, and he started Gorilla Systems at the same time, and I didn't even know him.
Wow, that's crazy.
And so,
so
there's
crazy.
Actually in Christchurch, there was like 3 or 4 kind of groups of people who had a sort of centrifugal kind of caricature or a character who's a DJ or somebody who had the organizational skills to go, man, we can do this. We can do this. I've actually got a great vision. Let's take it down to the beach in north, you know, Waimari, and have a call it cold water rave.
Yeah, right.
And let's do one that's up at up on Skellerup Park, which is above Victoria Park, and let's do it on that flat plateau there, and let's call it the Quickening. And let's do another one over in up at, along the way a bit at the Bellbird, which was actually quite a common one. Everyone liked to use that one because it had a stone building up there, and a lot of the Bellbird's early raves were done there because it was a combination of inside outside, and it was just quite easy. You could go up there, you could set up your gear, turn on your generator, and everyone could start the party.
And
Doc were not opposed to it.
Wow.
So that's quite special, right?
Yeah.
And when we did the Quickening, they said to us specifically, hey, no worries, this is great. What are you doing? What is it called? And we go, oh, it's like a multimedia AV show. And they're like, we definitely didn't use the word rave because at that particular time, interestingly, internationally, there was a really large pushback by the government about
rave culture.
Big pushback. And essentially, it was becoming illegal to actually dance in a public place, which sounds
insane.
crazy if you think about it. I mean, it's kind of like from the 1980s, you think of Footloose, that movie, Footloose, and that's the same subject to that movie, which is like,
all they want
to do is dance. Young people just want to have a bit of a boogie. And so anyway, we were over here doing that and going, okay, well, this is actually like quite challenging. To talk about the notion of rave was actually a bit of a no-no.
Yeah, right.
So the Doc were actually quite receptive, though. They were like, oh, the parks are for everyone. I mean, of course you can use them.
You have to
treat them with respect. And we were like, well, we were never intending on not treating them with respect. So absolutely, let's do this. And we did. We did some amazing spots for a period of like 2 or 3 years until they kind of became a little bit resistant to the notion of, you know, a bunch of kids or a bunch of young people or young at heart, or however you want to see them, raving around until dawn. Everyone would would do it until it was daylight.
Well, that's kind of part of like the idea of a rave, isn't it? There's some longevity to it.
Well, yeah, definitely. Multi genres. I think that really the biggest thing is raving is multiple genres and not afraid to kind of just change it. Okay, so after my set, it will change.
And
before me, it will be different. And so you get that moment where, like, normally what do you call a monoculture of electronic music is like it's the same genre all night. And everyone here will be quite used to that. It's all about consistency and having that kind of consistent sound.
Am I allowed to say it's really boring?
It can be, yeah. I mean, other times when it's really, you know, the artist is great, they do, you know, good performances are always going to be great performances.
Totally, but
you know, the change-up, you realise once you've had that experience that actually you get way more bang for buck from an appreciation of the music itself.
Totally.
Because you're just every 2 hours or so, it's like a whole different genre and a whole different vibe and a whole different energy in the crowd. And it's like, wow, this is really great. Like, that was an amazing thing about raving. It was really cool.
I want to actually touch on what you'll be playing, but before I do that, I did just want to ask, because like, surely eventually like communities and organizations and like the council and all that, eventually they caught on, right?
Yeah.
Well, then what happened?
I don't know. I think that kind of like I said in my, I've said this before on that news article, I said it was a sleepy town.
It's
kind of quite Orthodox Christchurch. It's, you know, it's in its name almost, you know, which is a little bit kind of, it's religious, it's Anglican, it's that sort of vibe. And we were just young, like you think about it from punk or post-punk culture,
which I
think I very much align with, you know, the Clash and Joe Strummer's sort of mentality, which is, you know, this is a rebellion of sorts of youth, you know, like youthful people quite often don't. They don't like the patriarchy. They don't like the way that corporate or capitalist views control the people. And music is a really great breakout. It just breaks out and represents the way that actually, I think, in an idealistic way, young people want the world to be.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. I would argue that hasn't changed at all.
No, I think so. Yeah, I think you're right. Yeah, no. So that sort of punk energy, that anarchy, is in essence what raving is kind of about. And in that sense, that the institutions, the people who are ultimately more on that conservative side.
Yeah.
Well, conservative might not be the right word, because ultimately ravers can be quite conservative as well.
Hey, true. Totally.
But people who have got structures around them, they've got bureaucracy, they've got things to protect.
Yeah, yeah.
They find that notion actually quite threatening.
Yes.
So it's been a hard, it's not actually been like I've been absorbed into common culture in Christchurch, or even broadly speaking, electronic music in New Zealand is not as celebrated as it probably should be.
Oh God, no.
And I think that's probably the real point that I think is you look at it, and we're predominantly kind of, we like guitars and bands and people who sing songs, but electronic music has a significant role, not just nationally, but it has this huge global influence that I think goes under-recognised a little bit. We could celebrate it more, and in that sense, that's what Saturday is about. It's about going back to those roots celebrating the beginning, a sort of beginning of sorts.
Is there anywhere you could point to and go, they acknowledge and celebrate electronic music properly?
Oh, God, you put me on the spot here.
Look,
I mean, there's certain awards, I would say, that were, like that... Mechanism, Denver McCarthy getting recognised,
was
really important. A lot of people won't have experienced or even heard his music, but he was so far before everybody.
Yeah, wow.
And he was an international superstar, really, kind of by standards.
Yeah.
But then there's other artists like Truth Jay Bulletproof, RIP, who also got recognised, and Natalia. These people deserve to be recognised, and they've got a fair point to have a gripe about it.
Because
if our culture, or let's say the institution around us, was celebrating it more, there'd be more of a highlight. There'd be additional problems, but there'd be more of a highlight, and I think it would give a richer, we'd have a more full kind of experience of music culture in New Zealand.
Oh, this is so interesting. I could honestly talk to you all day about this. Very quickly, fast forward to now. Saturday night, you're playing on the Flux stage with Gina Lynn as your MC, which will be lovely.
I never have an MC.
No. So what convinced you to?
I don't know. And there was no convincing needed. I actually just kind of impulsively thought, and I've been getting, I go and see those, I love Fix 8, I love what they do.
The artists
are just fantastic, and then I just kind of all of a sudden it just popped into my head that I remembered she was an MC as well, and I was like,
I love that.
It was just at the moment that I was like going, okay, well, I'm getting the lineup sorted, and I was like, I'm just going to ask her whether she might be into it, because I might be into it. So
cool.
Let's have a go.
Yeah, I love that. what can we expect to hear from you?
It's a game of two halves.
Okay, nice.
Excuse my rugby kind of reference.
No, no, it's all right.
It is a game of two halves. It's a set of two halves. The first half is a controller-based. I'm going to use a lot of digital music. That's because... and it's a bit of an ironic thing, actually. It's because the irony is that the early music of the set is all older music.
Right.
But I'm playing it on a more progressive digital format.
and then
the second half is newer music. I mean, new meaning the second half of the 90s.
Yeah.
But I'm playing it on vinyl.
I'm so confused by this.
But I've got a lot of vinyl, of course.
Yeah,
and so I've been back, half of my set's vinyl and half of the set's digital. And the reason the digital stuff is only because I can't buy that music. I can't find it. I couldn't buy it if I wanted to. It cost me too much.
Of course,
But I do, this is a lot of the stuff that was on those mixtapes I mentioned earlier.
Right.
Okay. So the cool thing is I get to DJ some of these very early pieces of music that inspired me to become a DJ.
And yeah, wow. I get so to, we kind of get your story a little bit.
You totally get a chunk like my story. And there'll be a bunch of people there this Saturday.
Doing the same thing, hopefully.
Well, no, that, who will remember, because the music is fantastic.
Yeah,
You hear a certain sound, you only need a snippet of it. And you're like, I know that tune.
That's a beautiful thing about music. It's fascinating.
And in this context, I think there'll be a lot of people who will have those little mind bombs going on for them right the way through my set. We'll be like, I remember this tune. I remember when it dropped. I know that vibe of that track.
Oh, God.
So that's cool. You know, that's another wicked. Really cool thing.
And nostalgia, the power of nostalgia.
That's right.
It's great. Yeah, it's wonderful.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, Pylon, thank you so much for coming in. To talk to me today, although this is like your place of work, so
I'm going to go get to work.
Yeah,
thanks great. For having me, though.
It is my absolute pleasure, and thank you for coming up with this idea in the first place.
Yeah, looking forward to it.
Oh, I'm so excited for it.